here, 97.5 The Fanatic. I bet you didn't think that we were going to talk about similes and metaphors, that Tyler was going to show off his literary chops, that we were going to invoke F. Scott Fitzgerald. Covered a lot of ground, and we're only halfway home. 610-632-0975. Before we get to Mike in South Philly, who wants to talk about the Eagles left tackle situation, for context, Tyler, let's hit this again. The perspective that the Eagles have on Jason Peters and whether or not the team has been in contact with the longtime left tackle this offseason.
With Jason Peters, listen, we've always said that we'd stay in touch with him during the offseason, and we have. Jason Peters is a tremendous, not only a football player, but he's a tremendous Philadelphia Eagle. And I got a lot of respect for a guy like Jason Peters to play that left tackle position for so many years at a high level. And so I have a lot of respect for his game and what he has accomplished in his career.
Yeah, there's a but coming. But the other thing is, of course, that doesn't seem to me like the book is completely closed either on the Jason Peters era here in Philadelphia. So with that in mind, now we go to Mike in South Philly on 97.5 The Fanatic. Hey, Mike.
Hey, you know, regarding Jason Peters, I still felt that there were plays last year that he made that, you know, only few NFL can make, where he just manhandled one of the players, the opponent, specifically the playoff game, actually, versus the Seahawks, where he made some really good plays. So I would not mind bringing him back. But I look at the team as from an overall standpoint. You know, as a general manager, you know, we've heard Howie say that he felt really good about this offseason. But the problem I have with that was that he felt really good going into last offseason and the year before. And both seasons, they started 5-6. So I really feel that as a general manager, your job is to do a little bit more. And what I mean by that is at any point it comes where you feel you did your job and you did enough, go the extra mile and make another move or two. And what I mean by that is, whether it's bringing in a Carlos Hyde, going out and getting a Jadeveon Clowney, I still think that they need one or two more moves, legitimate moves, to really feel good about themselves, because you never know if you did enough, and therefore always take that extra mod, that extra step, and try to make, just, you know, push the envelope a little bit further. And even if it's hard, you don't want, you know, it costs money, whatever it might be, I just feel like they're still a little short. And that's why you can go get a Carlos Hyde, bring back a Jason Peters, or maybe get a Clowney. Do you agree with that?
Well, so, Mike, the problem that I would have with it, I feel like any other season I might. But the problem is that you're already kind of incorporating all of these new pieces without the opportunity to get out on the grass with them, as Doug Peterson put it. I don't know how much change you're going to be able to successfully integrate because of the virus and because of how limited your contact is with your players this offseason. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I just think, like, whenever you add talent to a team, it's always a good thing. You know, legitimate talent, not like, you know, older players. And
sure.
I think you have certain guys like a Clowney who has talent where, worst case scenario, it doesn't make your team worse. And the best case scenario can really help you. I just feel like there are maybe a couple of moves that they can make to better about themselves. I still don't feel like they did enough considering what happened last year. They're starting with 5-7 and knowing how many good teams are in the NFC. You never want to see them.
Uh-oh, Mike, you're kind of breaking up here, man. I hear you. Thanks for the phone call, man. I don't know what happened. But your point is right, that obviously any time that you add an influx of talent, it clearly helps. There's no question at all. I don't know, for example, like with Jadeveon Clowney. To me, that seems like a misallocation of resources in that, you know, the salary demands seem to be pretty high. I don't think that was it Adam Kaplan who said that the Eagles might be interested in Clowney for less than $10 million per season? Hard for me to see a world where that exists. I don't think that there is a lot to that. Could it work? Yeah, it could work, but you've already got considerable resources financially, draft-wise, et cetera, invested in the defensive line. I don't know that that would be something that I would sign up for. I need to know more about the other backs that the Eagles added this year before I get married to the idea of a Carlos Hyde. Now, do they want somebody to fill the Jordan Howard role, the LeGarrette Blount role? Yeah, absolutely. 100%. But I also was thinking that you might have that guy elsewhere. You might have that guy in some of the other areas. Like, for example, you look at the Eagles depth chart this year. for who their running backs are right now. You've got Sanders, Scott, Clement, Holyfield. And then there are additional tailbacks that they have signed through undrafted free agency, et cetera. So you go further down the list. Michael Warren is one of them. Adrian Killens Jr. Like, neither of those guys are likely, especially not Killens, the LeGarrette Blount types. Michael Warren might be from Cincinnati. 5'9", 226. That's a load in that frame. I just need to know more about, what else he can do. I didn't watch, admittedly, a whole lot of Cincinnati games.
Well, and again, the problem comes back to they get so comfortable. And the one part that that our friend Mike did bring up, they seem to get comfortable and then not go that extra step.
Right.
Where they got a lot of productivity from an undrafted running back in Corey Clement 3 years ago, who, by the way, should have probably been at minimum a fifth or sixth round pick.
For sure.
And the fact that he went undrafted was ridiculous. They got a great productivity from him, and they go, okay, well, we did that once. We scraped the bottom of the barrel and came up with gold. Let's do it again. When, in reality, the likelihood of when you scrape the bottom of the barrel, what you're going to come up with is nothing, is much more likely.
So if you're the Eagles this year, and I think that I've made my position on this pretty clear, that I would have gone more veteran this offseason because of what's going on with, the virus and everything else, that would kind of run contrary to the way that I would typically build a team. Tyler, based on what you've heard our callers talk about, and based on what you've seen with the Eagles, based on their needs and where they sit now, would you have brought in more younger pieces, people who haven't been in the system, or is kind of like retention the way to go with the way that things have played out this offseason?
Yeah, I think that this particular offseason's kind of weird, like you mentioned, with there being very few planned anything left. When it first started, it was like, okay, maybe OTAs will be out, maybe rookie camp will be out, but it seems to be the case that it might be just a training camp and some preseason, might just be some preseason at this point. So I think it might be a little different, but I think personally, I gotta try something different. Whether it's young, whether it's veteran, I know that the playbook will be difficult to pick up when you're not actually on the field and running the plays and kind of retaining everything. But I have to, in my opinion, try something different to get over and ascend that 9-7 mark. Because last year it was good enough to win you a division. Is that good enough to win you a division a second straight year? Probably not.
Well, last year we were talking about the NFC least. We were talking about it being an historically bad division, right? That's why where 9-7 gets you. Sometimes we've seen division winners at 7-9, and it's not something that you usually want to be messing with. The good news is for the Eagles, I am more confident that the Eagles will make the playoffs no matter what, period, because obviously, there's another wildcard team. As Tyler pointed out, I thought that this was something that would take place in a couple of seasons. Tyler kept me honest. He's like, no. This is this year that we've got the extra wildcard team. You clown. 610-632.
I don't believe I used the term clown. I don't think so.
No, I'll fill in that gap. That's no problem. I got that. I'll fill in that gap. So we've got all of that on the table. And then coming up at 9 o'clock, we're going to hear from James Palmer, who joined Mike Missanelli from NFL Network. Really fascinating perspectives on a couple of different things that the league has going on, including the reopening, including the reworking of the Rooney Rule and the tabling of the proposal for incentivizing minority hires in general manager, executive, and head coaching positions. A lot of good stuff there. That's coming up at 9 o'clock, so we'll pay attention there. Also wanted to update this. Because when we were last together, we were talking about DeAndre Baker and Quentin Dunbar for robbery. DeAndre Baker pleaded not guilty to his 8 charges related to an alleged armed robbery that police say took place last week in Miramar. Quentin Dunbar also plans to plead not guilty to his 4 armed robbery charges this afternoon. This was written at about 1 o'clock, so I'm assuming that this already happened. This is the next step after both players were granted bail, $200,000 for Baker, $100,000 for Dunbar. On Sunday night, following a night in Broward Sheriff's Office jail, satisfying their arrest warrants from the alleged incident. In the coming weeks, the state's attorney's office will decide whether to go forward through toward trial in each player's case. The burden of proof is obviously on the state, which saw its four victims recant their story to police in sworn affidavits to Greco, who is the attorney in this case of, whose is it? Quentin Dunbar. Within 36 hours of the event, the fifth person identified as witness, Dominic Johnson, also signed an affidavit saying the players weren't culpable of this alleged crime. Several affidavits clearing the clients, according to Greco. So we'll see. The Giants told Baker to stay away from team meetings and focus on his legal issues at the time. Dunbar and Baker have both apologized for the distraction to their teams. So that means that you've got both of these guys pleading not guilty. You've got witnesses recanting stuff. This is so bizarre. We talked about how strange it was. The only thing that would have been stranger is for all of the witnesses, which apparently is happening right now, to go back and be like, oh, yeah, well, never mind. That never happened. I don't know what's happening.
So my question is, without, you know, diving into the legality of things.
Right.
Were stories made up? Were they fabricated? Were they
misremembered?
Yeah. Were they made to be a little bit more intense than what they really were? And it's kind of what you brought up about a week ago from today. Were there no cameras in the place?
Right. How do you not? We got to know. Got to know the details. There's footage of everything today. I'm with you, man. But I'll be watching that with interest, obviously, in the interest of fairness. We talked about when the arrest warrants were served and everything else. So obviously, any details we will also provide for you there. 610-632-0975, your phone number to join the conversation. Also, the NFL chief medical officer was talking today about coronavirus and how things are going to proceed. Here's NFL chief medical officer Dr. Alan Sills. He says, we fully well expect that we will have positive cases that arise. Because we think that this disease will remain endemic in society, it shouldn't be a surprise that new positive cases arise. Our challenge is to identify them as quickly as possible and prevent spread to any other participants. We're working very diligently on that, and we'll have some detailed plans at a later time. The NFL was talking a lot about, you know, reopening and et cetera, et cetera. Here's Sills more. He said, we're not putting dates on the calendar at this point because I'm looking at this as not date-based, but science and technology-based. We feel there are certain important steps that need to occur with regard to testing, with regard to test availability, with regard to test reliability, and also our continued evolution of understanding of how to manage exposures. All of those things are continuing to evolve. When we and the Players Association feel that we are at a point of satisfaction with that science, then we'll be ready to move forward. And also he talked about the NFL wants to make sure that they're not affecting the supply of tests needed in the healthcare system in any of their markets or around the country at large, and that's a strong commitment from everyone. So not necessarily any new information, but if you're one of the people, as I am, and I don't want to speak for Tyler, I believe that Tyler might fall into this camp as well, that kind of believes that the NFL locomotive is just planning on full steam ahead, at least this statement says, well, maybe not, if they're not looking at it as date-based, and there are some of these other steps that need to be accomplished before the Players Association, for one, and the league would feel comfortable moving forward.
Yeah, I've been very adamant about not getting things going until there is globalized and widely accessible testing for the general public, because I can't waste tests on, and again, my thing's always been not the people, right? The athletes should get it too as human beings. But I can't put a product on my TV for entertainment's sake ahead of people that might need it more.
Got it.
Right? So that's my stance. With that being said, I also understand that the NFL probably believes itself to be higher than the law and higher than most, you know, religions, to the point where they're going to do everything they can to get this thing going. This is kind of shocking to me that there might be a wrench in things. If it's not to their full standards, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, because I just assume that it's like, yep, we're starting and whatever happens, happens. Like, that's how I feel like they truly believe.
Well, I
don't know if that's the case now.
I was thinking that the TV contracts would be enough to push the NFL towards opening without fans no matter what. But there are more reports coming out talking about the actual financial impact on the owners as well if there are no fans in the stands. That some people are bringing up, like, if it's a question of opening in September and if you have a lot more access to testing or information or whatever come October, would the league consider pushing back by a month if that meant that there was a chance that fans could be in the stands in October as opposed to just fulfilling your TV contracts on the dates that you're going to do it? It's something that I hadn't considered before, and it could be a powerful motivating factor as well.
Well, I think that certainly comes to, it'll come to the decision based on when does fiscal year end for the NFL? You know, we talked about it with Mike Poorman a couple weeks ago, that college could play whenever up until a certain amount, a certain date, and get that money. If the NFL is the same way, then I would imagine they would be okay with it, because if they're going to recoup by X date in, you know, June or May or whatever it might be, they're going to get their money anyway. So they might as well do it. Might as well push it back a month.
Right, exactly. Exactly right. 610-632-0975, your phone number to join the conversation. On Twitter, it's at Joe Torti, at 97.5 The Fanatic, and at Tyler Zuli. Yeah, so I did not expect to read that from the NFL. Now, I'm not saying that this guy is definitely, I cannot stress this enough, that this could be completely sincere. I also know that there is a balancing act that each of these leagues is having to do with players' associations. Correct me if I'm wrong. The impression that I've gotten from reading about a lot of the reopening plans are that the players' unions seem to be slower to want to jump back into reopening things, as they're keeping in mind player safety and everything else, than the leagues themselves have been. So part of this is likely the league showing an olive branch, or extending an olive branch to the Players Association, saying that we want to be partners on this with you, rather than having this end up being, for example, in Major League Baseball, what looks like it's going to be a labor dispute amid a pandemic. Smart move by the NFL, if that is even fractionally part of what the story is.
For sure. And I think that's exactly what they're doing, is looking at the MLB and going, okay, we want this to be us versus, you know, as much as it can be, us versus coronavirus, versus right, us versus you, the players, versus the coronavirus. You know, it's going to be like that some kind of triple threat match that no one can win.
Right, a war on multiple fronts.
Right.
Exactly.
So the best thing that they could do is be some sort of, as best they can, a united front to combat this whole thing, and then, you know, start when they can start.
Yeah, and I do wonder if this will result in more collaboration than, say, we'll see in Major League Baseball. Because I anticipate in Major League Baseball, I don't see a way that this goes other than contentiously. Because the salary cap, the prorated salaries, that sort of thing, versus revenue sharing, that's kind of become central to this, in addition to all of the safety measures that you hope to take and all of the issues that you would have with a return to baseball. It's become about more than just the virus, effectively. I'm surprised that this turn happened in the NFL. I to be quite honest, I'm very surprised that the locomotive would even slow down for the train tracks of, like, hey, what do the players want to do? But it's encouraging, certainly. And that also leads me to believe, and maybe this is just me being naive, it leads me to believe that if that is the focus from Jump Street, it's possible that the season might not be profoundly interrupted, which is to say pushed back to a February or March start or something like that. It's possible that everybody pulling in the same direction could result in as minimal a delay as possible. I don't know that to be sure, but just the vibe that I'm getting from the league and from the Players Association together. Because don't get me wrong, I saw Treader, who's the new Players Association president. I think J.C. Treader is the president, was talking about how NFL players are not robots. They're not, you know, machines, and that coronavirus is not going to kneel down to the almighty NFL, and that there are NFL players with pre-existing conditions who are focused on keeping their families healthy in addition to keeping themselves healthy. It's a contact disease. This is what he said. Contact disease, and we play a contact sport. There are lots of guys with underlying conditions and problems that we have to look out for. But he also said there's no bad idea at this point when it comes to protecting players. When it came out that NFL engineers in Oakley are testing prototypes for modified face masks that might contain surgical or N95 material, which is what Adam Schefter reported earlier today. New ideas, more ideas. I think that that is almost evidence, right, that the collaborative approach seems to be more productive than the sneaky labor dispute approach.
Normally, the throw a bunch of things against the wall, hope something sticks approach is a really bad way to go about changing the sports world. This is the exception to that rule, where if you can throw a whole bunch of things out there and find the one that is the best suited, the best safe, and the one that is both safe and can get the product on the field as soon as possible, I think we're all for it. Again, assuming for my standards that it doesn't take up, you know, testing for the everyday person.
Well, so here's the other reason why, and it's not through any merit of the Players Association or the NFL, but here's the other reason why I'm less worried about this affecting the NFL season than I am about, like, the end of the NBA or the NHL, which I am not convinced will resume. Think about, it is May 19th. The NFL season is just about 4 months away. Think about 4 months ago when it was January 19th. And think about what national awareness was of the virus and everything. There were people that knew that it was going on, you know, internationally. But it certainly did not take center stage in our lives the way that it has now 4 months later. And think about how differently we perceive things now as we did 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. The world's just rapidly changing. By September, we're going to have at least that much more new information, new developments, things like that. The NFL, just quite frankly, relative to a lot of these other leagues, has time on its side. Really does just have time on its side. So I think that that is, like I said, through no merit of the league or the Players Association, a benefit that they have that some of these other sports do not have. I'm incredibly curious to see what the landscape looks like come September, considering how rapidly things have developed there. 610-632-0975. It is the Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
97.5 The Fanatic.
So one of the best parts of watching The Last Dance is watching people learn that Michael Jordan was a bully that didn't know. The Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic. Tyler, have you caught up with this with The Last Dance and stuff like that?
Yeah, we're good.
So there are people talking about you know, the Horace Grant thing and, like, you know, Michael Jordan being a bully. I think that there's a difference, right? I think that Kobe Bryant would get all over you regardless of who you were. But there were stories that I thought I vaguely remembered about Michael Jordan trying to step to people and having it not work. And those did not come up really in The Last Dance.
No, you know? just the Steve Kerr one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So I thought, this is from Jackie McMullen, which is fantastic. Talking about Robert Parrish. Okay. Parrish left the Celtics in 1994 for Charlotte, where he played two seasons. His final year in the league was 96-97, where he played with Michael Jordan in Chicago and won another ring. There, he regained an appreciation for Bird's leadership style. Quote, "What set Larry apart from Magic and Jordan was he wasn't an in-your-face leader like they were," Parrish said. "He had too much respect for us. If you weren't having a good night, he was more inclined to encourage you or not say anything at all. But Magic and Jordan would jump all over you." In one of his first practices with the Bulls, Parrish botched one of the plays and was amused to find Jordan jawing at him just inches from his face. "I told him, I'm not as enamored with you as these other guys. I've got some rings too," Parrish recalled. At that point, he told me, "I'm going to kick your bleep." I took one step closer and said, "No, you really aren't." After that, he didn't bother me. Now, this is, I think that it's not going to be funny to people who don't realize, I'm pretty sure Robert Parrish was like a 7-foot black belt. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, he was well-trained in martial arts. So, like, Jordan making this realization, like, oh, yeah, I'm not gonna mess with this guy, I don't think. You never hear about these.
So, the question then being is it pick-and-choose tough guy? Is it, maybe not pick-and-choose, but if they don't step up, I'm going to take it out even harder on them?
That is a bully thing, right? Like,
yeah.
Resistance is usually the thing that makes a bully go away, like any kind of resistance. Like, that's not worth it. But yeah, that's the impression that I'm getting, is like the people that were in awe of Jordan or wouldn't push back probably got it the worst. Bill Cartwright, and this is a story that I hadn't heard, so I'm just taking this from a tweeter. Bill Cartwright said that he would be known as Ground Jordan because he would break his bleeping legs if Michael Jordan ever aired him out again after singling him out after a bad game. Whoa!
Ground Jordan.
Ground Jordan. Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Jordan. That's good stuff. I hope that that's true. That's funny. Isn't that different? Like, to me, there is a difference between, like, I look at Tom Brady and Kobe Bryant as like the same, as like demanding excellence from teammates and stuff like that, and without it being personal. Jordan, I always viewed as more of like a bully. And I thought that that was an interesting part that was left out of the last.
I don't know about Kobe, and I don't know a lot about the Brady locker room situation, so yeah. It might be too. But the story I always found kind of amusing and also at the same time is definitely bully worth would be the day that he went into the Lakers locker room before the trade deadline, and apparently his quote was, "I'm just coming to say goodbye to you bums because you won't be here tomorrow." Like, that is... That's rough.
That's pretty
brutal. I mean, it's not as rough as, like, you know, I'm going to beat you up. But that's pretty rough.
So I remember there's one Kobe full-on bullying thing that I remember. And I don't know if anybody would remember this if they didn't attend Fordham University, because otherwise, why would you? But there was a guy named Smush Parker who was in the NBA who Kobe just absolutely hated. They shared a backcourt from 05 to 07, and they both, that was when the Suns were really good, and they lost in the first round of the Suns twice. In 2012, Kobe said, "Smush Parker was the worst. He shouldn't have been in the NBA, but we were too cheap to pay for a point guard, so we let him walk onto the team." Damn, man. Smush Parker's rough. There you go. So that was...
I feel like we're going to need to get a Kobe docuseries soon.
Oh, man. So perfect, Tyler. I'm so proud of you. It's like you're a true professional.
You know, we hang around once in a while.
Now,
I to be fair, I am the station Smush Parker.
Yeah,
they let me walk in.
Yeah, just because we're too cheap to pay a real producer.
No. Not anything like that. They just haven't fired me yet.
Oh, okay, all right. I think you've earned the spot because of segues like that. The Last Dance. I think that there's an appetite for stuff like this, but it would have to be the right person. You brought to my attention that people are talking about Ken Griffey Jr. People would want to see that. That could not be less interesting to me.
There's no story. I mean, unless there's something that we don't know, there's nothing to me that would be appetizing about a Griffey docuseries. Like, he was the first overall pick. He was really good. People think he has the best swing of all time. I tend to disagree, but I'm not going to argue you with it.
Who do you like?
Albert Pujols.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's a little cleaner. But anyway, side topic. But there's not a whole lot of resistance that we know of. I mean, and again, there could be stuff that we don't know. But we kind of knew something was going on with the Bulls in 98, and it took this long to get it out. Unless there's something we don't know about Griffey, I don't know what I want to see.
So, I mean, there are a couple of names that jumped out to me right away, right? One, the 30 for 30 on Ricky Williams was not enough. Like, I would need more. I could do more on Ricky Williams. If there was stuff that we could actually legitimately do about Andre the Giant or Wilt Chamberlain, like, these are the guys that I'd wanted, because you talk about larger than life, you know, people might not want to hear this. Something like this on Tiger Woods would kill. Would absolutely destroy. You know?
The Wilt one would be great, too.
Yep.
Especially if you could find any some kind of lost footage from, you know, the 50s and 60s.
Be unreal.
Be incredible.
Andre the Giant, I've talked about as an actual, like, he's a folk figure. Like, people tell stories about Andre the Giant like he's a superhero. I think the one for me is Tiger Woods. Like, if they ever did anything like this about Tiger Woods, it would be at least as big as The Last Dance, if not bigger.
I mean, rise, fall, rise again. I mean, that's the story that everybody wants to see.
That's exactly
right. It's Rocky, you know, get knocked down 8 times, get up 9 times.
Absolutely right. Did you have a better name than that one? It was on your head?
I mean, off the top of my head, I don't know. I've seen the like the steroid era baseball, I think, would be a good one if you could get the guys to be open and honest
totally
about
transparent.
It. Right. I would, because Canseco's been open and transparent about it, but you would need Bonds to do it. You would need McGuire to do it. You would need Sosa to do it. If they could get that, I'd be locked in.
Palmeiro.
Yeah, you would need Palmeiro to be open. And all of these guys would have to be transparent and upfront about it.
Yeah. Yep. I'm with you. But man, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, this is, first of all, it's perfect timing for The Last Dance, because there's, you know, no other sporting entertainment that a lot of people are watching to distract from it. But also, it's just a massive story. Michael Jordan is one of the cults of personality in sports, period. Tiger is the only one that I was thinking that would maybe hold a candle. I would absolutely watch that. 610-632-0975 is your phone number to join the conversation. On Twitter, it's at Joe Torti at 97.5, The Fanatic. Let's go to Ian in Newark on 97.5. What's going on, Ian?
Hey, what's up?
How you doing?
Yeah, what you guys kind of hit it on the head. I want to see one on Barry Bonds.
But so kind of with the same level of involvement that that Jordan had, that'd be fascinating.
Yeah, and I want to see him be transparent, though. I don't want this one-sided thing about it, but I want to hear the other people, because Jordan was so one-sided, though, you know.
So did that take anything away from you, Ian, as you were watching?
No, I would say it did. It was still good, but it gives me a different perspective of Jordan. When I thought of Jordan, I never liked him because what he did to the Sixers, but what changed my, I realized Jordan's an insecure guy. He doesn't really, he's just insecure. He wouldn't let anybody else talk bad about him and stuff. It's what it just seems like, though. But
sure. Well, I mean, for me, I realized that by the second episode of the documentary. So that's why I was like, oh, okay, it's going to be like a Jordan spin. And that's how I was like, okay, if it's going to be a Jordan kind of like almost spin show, then I can work my way through that. You know what I mean?
But as a basketball player, it gave me more respect to him because he's all about basketball. And Kobe's that way, too. I think, Kobe, when Kobe came in, he got bullied, too. I think Shaq and those guys were really hard on Kobe the first couple of years. So I want to see one on Kobe. And then wrestling-wise, Andre Giant had a 30 for 30, and that was fascinating. I don't know if you guys ever saw that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wanted more.
Yeah, now, I want to see one on Hulk Hogan, too, because Hulk Hogan's been through so much with the racism, the stuff with Bubba the Love Sponge. I want to see one on Hulk Hogan. And then the old guys, I mean, they're so old. They're like Babe Ruth and stuff, but it's too past time, you know? So,
sure, yeah, of course. But, well, yeah, I'm always fascinated. And Ian, thanks for the phone call, man. Sorry, we're up against it here. Got to let you go. But good names, for sure. I always would hope Like, I've learned so much about watching, like, basketball clips from, like, the 60s and 70s about players that I'd never had the chance to see live. I would hope that there'd be a generation of sports fans that could learn about some of these legends of yesteryear before being so quick to say that this guy or that guy's the best whatever of all time. That's my hope. I don't think it'll happen, though.
Yeah, I think people are a little bit too stubborn for that.
That's the way it goes. 610-632-0975. Joe Torti's show rolls on right here on 97.5 The Fanatic.
97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
97.5 The Fanatic.
Welcome back. Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic. The Big 12 Conference does not yet have a date for sports to resume, but Commissioner Bob Bowlsby said on Tuesday, which is, of course, today, that the league needs to be up and running by mid-July if the college football season is going to start on time. If we're not, we're looking at probably having to delay the season a little bit, but it's too early to know if we're going to be able to make that or not. I've always looked at college sports as in a little bit of a different vein than pro sports when it comes to the return, just because I don't know how you could justify having college sports going on if the general student population is not back on campus. You know what I mean? Like, these people are not employees. They're not professionals. You know, they're presumably student athletes in a lot of these cases, right? So I always found the return to sports to be much more tenuous in the college arena versus the pro arena. Having said that, having everything be up and running by July 12th, I don't know what that necessarily means. I know the college football is tentatively scheduled to start on August 29th. The May 31st moratorium that was imposed in March at the onset of the virus pandemic is, you know, we're rapidly approaching the conclusion of that. Multiple sources told ESPN that the SEC athletic directors are meeting with health officials on Thursday, and then they're going to make a recommendation to the league's university presidents and chancellors about whether to permit student athletes to return to campus as soon as June 1st for voluntary workouts. And then the Big 12 is going to have similar conversations. Bowlsby said they have to have testing and assurances that systems are in place to deal with positive tests, treat people after a positive test, triage, hospital-level disinfectant in all of the activity spaces. There's just a lot of layers of systems that have to be put in place. When asked about the potential for a competitive advantage should the SEC allow athletes to return earlier, Bowlsby said the conference commissioners are in constant communication with hopes of similar timelines. So they're trying to avoid those things. And everybody apparently is trying to maintain similar timelines. So there you go. Like I said, it's tough to predict because even August is quite some time away. Not as far as September when you're talking about the pro football season. But there's still a lot of stuff that can happen and developments that can occur between now and then. But it is a difficult job that these college commissioners have to set up because there could be, I don't know for sure, there could be just a day where all of a sudden it's like, all right, the green light is given. You know, like the all clear is up there. I don't know if there is, say, like a vaccine that's established tomorrow if everyone would take it or if widespread testing or whatever would come on. And then all of a sudden it's like greenlit, good to go, all set. And if you haven't been preparing to get ready by then, if you're the SEC commissioner or you're the Big 12 commissioner or whatever, then you're going to be behind the eight ball and you're not going to be able to explode into action as quickly as, you know, you would need to in order to make things go smoothly at the beginning of the seasons. But that's what I mean. It's a very difficult balancing act that these guys are going to have to navigate and negotiate when it comes to the resumption of college sports. With pro sports, you can kind of set up a long-term game plan, and it's just kind of contingent on what you and the government and the Players Association all can agree to. In college sports, I would say that you have additional hoops to jump through, thus making the jobs of these commissioners and these university presidents and chancellors and stuff pretty difficult when it comes down to college sports.
You know, the one thing that I keep going back to with, especially with the way that baseball is being handled right now, these are professionals with signed contracts and money is exchanged. In the collegiate ranks, money goes one way, and it's not to the way of the players.
Right.
So are they going to have almost no say in what happens in safety precautions, procedures, or whatever happens? If the college says, all right, we're ready to go, we feel like this is safe, you know, and then the coach is going to, they're going to listen to the college, obviously, because that's their employer. And then these players have to listen. It's like this trickle down of who's responding to who, who's responding to who. I don't know if these players are going to have any kind of say or structure I don't want to say authority, but help in making decisions when it comes to if they're back on the field or not.
Well, yeah. And the other part is that conceivably, like, the answer would be like, we're not going to make anybody do anything that they're uncomfortable with, right? But if you are, you know, a college swimmer whose education relies on you being able to compete or something like that, you're going to end up being put between a rock and a hard place unless you have assurances that your education can just be delayed rather than, you know, you lose your scholarship if you don't show up.
Right, and that's the thing is we oftentimes just are looking at this on the biggest macro level of football, basketball, because they're the two biggest money grabs and they're the two ones that are on the TV the most. If, I don't know, let's take an example, Trevor Lawrence, right? Trevor Lawrence says he doesn't want to play, and Clemson goes, okay, well, you are not on the roster, so we have to rescind your scholarship. Trevor Lawrence is probably going to go work out privately for a season, and he's still going to be a top five pick in the NFL next year.
Correct.
That swimmer that you just mentioned, if they don't swim, they get their scholarship rescinded. What is their next step? They pay for school themselves. What if they don't have financial stability? What if they don't have the ability to apply for student loans?
Even going to work is in question with all of this. Right.
So that swimmer is now technically a dropout of college, right? It's going to be harder for them to find the job that they were pursuing with their degree. Things will be harder to jump through. It'll be more hoops to jump through for them. Trevor Lawrence is still going to get the job that he sought out to get. He's going to be an NFL quarterback.
Right, exactly. So it's not just about, and I think that oftentimes when people look at issues of college athletics and college sports, first of all, they only look at college football and college basketball, and they only look at the elite level schools where these guys are effectively coming out of factories to join, you know, the pro ranks. And obviously these issues have much further reach than just those two sports, and certainly than just the players who were going to be making their bones continuing their sport at the next level. So these are all of the things that these commissioners are trying to work through now. But the good news is that more and more information is coming out. So obviously the decisions are going to be considerably more informed than they would have been if you had to make a call on this at the beginning of March.
Well, I think for a lot of these schools and a lot of these athletes, you're going to end up having worry that they're going to end up doing what Furman just did and cutting the baseball and lacrosse programs for the men's side. I looked at their schedule. The baseball team was 26-31 last year. It's not great, but they weren't, you know, 4-50.
Yeah, you don't think of that as being like a droppable record.
Right. That's not a program that you cut. Now all of a sudden it is. We talked about Cincinnati soccer was like the first domino to fall 2 months ago. It's really going to be difficult for a lot of these schools to figure these things out.
610-632-0975 is your phone number to join the conversation. Speaking of figuring things out, One of the big mysteries regarding those Jordan era Bulls has finally been solved. Now, I wanted to share this because I thought this was tremendous work. The flu game, apparently not the flu game after all. This was the revelation that the food poisoning theory ended up being right after all the whole time. Absolutely mind-blowing to me. I've got to find which radio station this guy was on so that I can properly credit. But did you see this? They had the pizza guy on, the pizza delivery guy who's...
Yes! I don't know how that happened.
That's mind-blowing. That is a tremendous radio. So this was... let's pull up his testimony here. And I think we have it in our audio archives. But Craig Feight joined the Big Show on 1280 The Zone in Salt Lake City to give like his side of the story in the was Michael Jordan poisoned or not in the flu game situation. This is what he had to say. This is, I'm assuming, courtesy of 1280 The Zone in Salt Lake City. Yeah, we'll get it up in a second. You know what? Actually, we'll it's so good. It's going to prompt this discussion that we can actually just wait. We'll wait until we return on the other side, and then we can share it on the other side. 610-632-0975. All right. Also, coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we will hear from James Palmer, who joined Mike Missanelli to discuss all things NFL. James Palmer of the NFL Network. Lots of ground covered in this interview, and I thought it was very good. One of the best things that I've heard all day, so that's why I wanted to make sure that it was shared with you as well if you missed it. Looking forward to that. Of course, more of your phone calls. We do have wide open phone lines, 610-632-0975. On Twitter, if you want to connect with the show, you can reach me at Joe Torti. Tyler is at Tyler Zuli. And of course, connect with the station at 97.5 The Fanatic. We do have an hour more of jam-packed programming. So we've got pizza delivery guy gate coming up, James Palmer, more of your phone calls. One More Thing is coming up at 9:50. So don't go anywhere. It is the Joe Torti Show, 97.5 The Fanatic.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.